It's a really great pleasure to be here, to see Donald Coxeter again, who's, well, let me get a, say I'm getting ahead of myself. I just want to step back 20 years, if I may, to Professor Coxeter's 75th birthday celebrations. And I just want to tell you a little story. There were, of course, all the people there were students of Coxeter or grand students of Coxeter or maybe even great grand students of Coxeter. And they were all getting up saying how this man had been the great inspiration of their lives. Well, I just, you know, rather brashly thought I'd do something different. And when I stood up, I said I was here to forgive Professor Coxeter for having tried to murder me. And I told the story, which actually has elements of the truth about it. A long, long time ago, Professor Coxeter came to Cambridge and gave a lecture. And I didn't realize at the time, but that was his attempt to murder me. He chose for his weapon something that Agatha Christie never thought of, a mathematical problem. Obviously, I mean, what actually happened, I walked out of the lecture room and crossed the main road in Cambridge, and just as I was in the middle of the road, the solution hit me. And it wasn't the only thing that hit me. A large garbage truck hit me. Well, fortunately, it didn't do too much damage. It was an unsuccessful attempt at murder. But after being shouted at by the people hanging on at the back, I limped back to the room and told Professor Coxeter this and so on. Well, now I'm here to apologize for saying that, because it wasn't true, of course. Professor Coxeter has been the great inspiration of my mathematical life. I wrote to him when I was a high school kid in Liverpool first, and I'd just like to tell you what that was about, because it happens that it's about one of the four-dimensional regular polytopes, the hypercube. So here I've drawn a hypercube, roughly. Actually, one of my sort of delights is in drawing these things and getting them roughly right freehand, and you're not going to be able to see much of that just yet. Maybe I'll show you a little bit. But anyway, here's a picture, and I've numbered it. Well, let me just sort of write this to hint at the numbering. Here's vertex number one. If you go straight down, that's direction 8, you'll get to vertex number 9. Except you'll see I've crossed off vertex number 9 here. What happens is after you've numbered it in the standard way, which I did in white, you probably can't see the difference between green and white, I crossed off half the numbers, alternate vertices, and substituted the number of the opposite vertex. So here's vertex 2 crossed off. It was opposite to number 15, so I renumber it 15. Okay? Alternate vertices, I renumber. Now, can somebody just sort of pick one of the numbers here, please? Just give me a number, quick. 7. Okay. And now, what's joined to 7? Just name a number joined to 7. 9. Okay. And now let's have another one joined to 9. Oh, sorry. You can choose your direction. 4. 7, 9, where are we? 7, 9, 4, and then completing the square, we would get 14. Okay? So that's the way we'll go around. 7, 9, 4, 14. Now let's just choose another direction from 7. Let's choose 2, say. 2. But now I'm going to go in the same direction. So it'll be 2, 16, 5, 11. Okay, I did that one. I've done that one. Now I should do this one. 13, 3, 10, 8. And 12, 6, 15, 1. I don't want to explain too much, so forgive me if you didn't quite follow what I was doing there. But basically, there are 384 different ways you could choose which order to write these things in. This object here is a magic square. it's actually a pan-diagonal magic square. That's to say, not only the main diagonals, but also the broken diagonals, like that one. Oh, sorry, coming back to here, have the magic sum. In fact, every little square parallel to the sides has the magic sum. So 2, 7, 9, and 16 add up to 34, which is the sum for this thing. And the rows, columns, diagonals, and every square. It's quite an amazing thing. There are precisely 384 magic squares like this, of this particular kind. But there are also 384 different symmetries of the hypercube. And so what actually happens is there's an exact correspondence, a really beautiful thing. You pick up this hypercube, imagine it's a die in four dimensions, throw it up in the air, catch it, and sort of stick it back where it was before, and then you get a different one of these squares, and you get all 384. So I wrote off that to Professor Coxeter, and he wrote me, as you can imagine, those of you who have ever written to him, a beautiful letter, at which I treasured. Let's come to the question of regular polytopes and polyhedra. In particular, let me get a little bit closer to the object outside by talking about a dodecahedron. So you heard Professor Cox to give a visual description of this as a pentagon inside a decagon, which I'm now drawing. And you see that the remainder of the decagon is made of five pentagons that are a bit distorted by the projection. fine. Well, there are, as well as the convex regular polytopes in three dimensions, or convex regular polyhedra, there are some more that are star-shaped. And I just want to say a little bit about those first, because this is another thing that I spoke to Professor Coxeter about, but this time a lot later. The letter I'm talking about, I've worked out, must have been at least 46 years ago, since I left the high school 46 years ago. Take a pentagon. If you produce the edges, you get a pentagram. Or, if you like, you can call it a stellated pentagon. So what can you do analogously to that in three dimensions? Well, if you take a dodecahedron, it has a lot of pentagons. If you stellate them, I'm only suggesting this, but still pretty good for a freehand drawing. You get a stellated dodecahedron, and I'm going to draw one face of it so you can sort of see it here. I hope you can see it. These faces all intersect each other, and it's really rather hard to see. You see, in front of this, there's another corner sticking out. Anyway, this object has... let me go back to the original dodecahedron for a moment. Incidentally, I'm really shamefully proud of my ability to draw a regular polyhedra. I have the following sort of dream, that one day I'll be out somewhere in a dusty square somewhere in the west, and there will be a sort of burly man coming towards me like this. And suddenly, you know, I find myself walking towards him in this dream, and suddenly I whip out a pad of paper and draw regular icosahedron or something before he does, and I win. Anyway, but here's a dodecahedron. As Professor Coxton was saying, its vertex figure, that's what you get if you chop off a vertex, is a regular triangle, and so it's called 5,3. Hi, oh, here's a stellated dodecahedron. Thank you. There's the object I was trying to draw. It has, now this is called 5 in the Schläfli symbol, and this is 5/2. And the reason is that each edge takes you 1/5 of the way round here, and here it takes you 2/5 of the way round, and you invert that. anyway, and this has 5/2 gums to each vertex, and there are 5 of them round a vertex. So this is 5/2, 5. Okay. But there's another thing that you can do, which is, let me switch to a colour of chalk that will, I hope, look different. You could replace this small pentagon by this greater pentagon here. If you do that, well, I won't bother to try and draw it on top of here, you'll get another polyhedron called the great dodecahedron. And then you can stellate the great dodecahedron. So that greaton produces this pentagon. And if you do both, you'll get this pentagram. And there are altogether, this means that there are 6 different polyhedra with what we call, say, pentagonal symmetry. And they're drawn in this diagram, which is taken from one, in fact, it's probably taken from several of Professor Coxeter's books. I just want to illustrate something here. This direction is Grayton, and that direction is stellate. So from the dodecahedron, you can get to the stellated dodecahedron, which I told you was called 5/2, 5, or you can get to the great dodecahedron, or you can first stellate and then greaten that, or first greaten and then stellate, it doesn't make any difference, you get the great stellated dodecahedron. And then there's another polyhedron, the icosahedron, for which the face is a triangle, and again, you greaten to produce a larger triangle, and you get the great icosahedron. And the relations between these polyhedra are summarized in this little diagram here. Or perhaps I should say there's another operation of duality, or dualized, perhaps I should say, and yet another one of conjugacy. If you take the algebraic conjugates of all the vertices of this, you get the vertices of that. Conjugacy changes 5s into 5/2s. And this is a really nice diagram. I just want to explain this column, which is, you possibly can't all see. It says densities. If you're inside this thing and you want to get out, well, if you're inside the dodecahedron and you want to get out, you only have to cross one face. If you're inside, that's analogous to this. If you're inside a pentagon and you want to get out, you only have to cross one edge. But if you're inside a pentagram and you want to get out, you've got to cross 2 edges. So the density of a pentagram is 2. That's that little denominator there, in fact. The density of this thing is 3. If you want to get out, you first got to cross one of the pentagons of the original dodecahedron. That really means you're crossing twice, because that's in the middle of this pentagram. And the local densities, so to speak, are 1s in the points and 2 in the middle. So you first have to spend 2 units to get through a pentagon, and then you have to spend 1 unit to get through a point. So the density of this thing is 3. In other words, it's really drawn on a surface, a Riemann surface surrounding the sphere, and it covers that surface 3 times, and that's these densities. Well, I just want to sort of say something about the corresponding 4-dimensional objects. because some time ago I made this wonderful cuboctahedron. And it turns out that in four dimensions there are 12 pentagonal polytopes. You can not only get this object, now this we're calling the 120 cell, and that's the object outside, okay? But I want to introduce an alternative name for it. It's a polytope, and that means many shapes. And in this case, the shapes are dodecahedra. So if it's a polytope and the topes are dodecahedra, it's okay to call it a polydodecahedron. So I will introduce polydodecahedron as an alternative name for the 120-cell 533. Well, now, you can stellate the polydodecahedron. You can greaten it. Or you can aggrandize it. And what actually happens is this. Stellating is lengthening the edges. Now, the edges are one-dimensional things. Greatening is enlarging the faces, which are two-dimensional things. Aggrandizement is the next one up. You enlarge the three-dimensional things in the same way. It turns out that these 12 figures, well, let's go over here. This was stellation, the one-dimensional thing. That's why there's one arrowhead here. This was greatening. Let me perhaps write those things. It turns out these are the relationships. This, okay, you can, from the dodecahedron, you can stellate, or you can graten, or you can do both. From the icosahedron, well, there's no hope of stellating a triangle, but you can graten it. In four dimensions, the 12 polytopes we're talking about are related like this, and it's an analogous figure. Instead of a rectangle, you have a cuboid here in white, and then you have two additional lines. This I call the polytetrahedron because the cells are tetrahedra, and there are a lot of them, 600, which is really poly. And then there's another thing, the polyicosahedron. Anyway, that's that. But, you know, one of my aims, in fact, my real aim, I'm very, very glad indeed to have been invited here. My real aim was to try and tell Donald Coxeter something about polytopes that he didn't already know. Now, this is a big deal, and I'm not at all confident I can pull it off, but I am going to try. Maybe I'll try using this object. By the way, delightful. A friend of mine drew this picture of Professor Coxeter, and he just signed it, and I'm going to frame it when I get home. I'm afraid he'll have to rest on his side there. Okay, yes, please. It's probably best to take it in on the front. Namely, we were just talking about this Schlafly symbol. And there is a wonderful generalization of the Schlafly symbol, which I learnt about only a few years ago. Is it on? Yeah, okay. Which has delighted me utterly. Where did I put those? Oh, here. So much so that I've been doing essentially nothing else for the last few months. Let me try to illustrate that. Oh, by the way, perhaps I should just sort of emphasize what the next dimension up is. I mean, the thing outside is 533. That means that the cell is a dodecahedron, and they fit together tetrahedrally. The tetrahedron is 3, 3. Let me quickly draw a tetrahedron for you. Tetrahedron has triangles 3 to a vertex. I'm sorry, am I? You want me? Okay. You're scared that I might tread on him. Just as this, the cell was 5 and the vertex figure was 3, the pentagons fit together triangularly in a dodecahedron. Well, the new kind of symbol is really rather different, and I'm going to illustrate it, I think, with a cube octahedron. What we do, well, let me rapidly draw a cube octahedron again. That's good enough. What we do is we divide every face of this baricentrically, as the topologists say, which for a Briton means you sort of draw a Union Jack everywhere. except that if it's a triangular face, it's a sort of triangular Union Jack. You know, you just join the, technically, the center of the whole thing, the face, to the centers of all the vertices and edges around it, the center of a vertex being that vertex. And now we have a look and we see what types these are. And what actually happens here is all of these are the same type, which I'm going to call A, in the sense that there's a symmetry of the cube octahedron, taking any one of these 8 triangles onto any other one. And these are of the same type, which I'll call B, and these are the only 2 types in this solid. Let's mark each vertex of one of these little triangles with the dimension of the thing that it came from. So I've just put zeros on all the vertices of the objects. Now I'm going to put ones on the midpoints of the edges, because they're one-dimensional, and twos in the middle of each face of the original object, because they're two-dimensional. And now, what I do is I say, look, whenever 2 triangles share an edge, then there's some dimensional vertex that's changed, and the other 2 dimensions they have in common. Okay? And then what I say is these are connected at the K level. Let me just say K connection. So let me illustrate that. What is A connected to at the zero level? Well, I'm just copying a little piece of this picture. An A triangle is connected in the zero manner, that's to say, I change vertex 0 and keep the other 2, to an A triangle. Okay. So this is A and this is B. I have a line for each each type of these basic triangles. I say A is connected to itself at the zero level, and B is connected to itself at the zero level too. Let me just indicate that way. I'm just copying a little piece of that diagram. So B is connected to itself. Fine. What happens at the one level? Well, at the one level, if I look at that piece there, 0, 2, 1, 1, I see again that A is connected to itself. So I don't do any joining. Similarly, B is connected to itself. But at the 2 level, A is connected to B. Okay? Here's an A. And if I delete vertex 2, I'm passed to the triangle that shares every vertex except number 2 with this one, A is connected to B. And now, there's a little game that you do here, which is, A is 4. B is 3. I won't just explain these little numbers just yet, but you can sort of see the A's lead to a square, and that's why I put 4 here. The B's lead to a triangle, and that's why I've put 3 here. And here, if you alternately A and B along here, you'll get a square around this vertex. That's really the vertex figure. I'll show you that again in a moment. And this is the Delaunay symbol of the cube octahedron. And these are very beautiful things, and I want to sort of slowly explain them to you. First of all, let me try to say why this number here is 4. Well, it's because the vertex figure of the cube octahedron is indeed a square. Okay. So what this tells us, just, let me go back and say that the Delaunay symbol of a dodecahedron is that, and you'll see that's much the same as the Schlafly symbol. and the Delaunay symbol of the 120 cell that we're celebrating is that, again, the same as the Schlafly symbol. What does this symbol mean? Well, there's a thing that we always somehow think of as putting our thumb over things. If you put your thumb over the rightmost node in the Schlafly symbol, you get the Schlafly symbol of the cell. So the cells of the object outside are dodecahedra. If you put your thumb over the leftmost node, and I should say every line that joins it, you get the symbol of the tetrahedron, which is, or the vertex figure in this case. The same is true here, only it's a bit different. If you put your thumb, or let me put my eraser over the rightmost part of this symbol, I do indeed get the Delaunay symbol of the cell, except that there are two different kinds of cell. There's a square cell and a triangular cell in a cube octahedron. Isn't that useful? If I put my thumb over the left-hand side, I get the symbol of the vertex figure. Now, why this symbol is a square, why is it, in the octahedron, the symbol would look like that, and that would be the symbol for a square. Why has this symbol got two lines, whereas this one only had one? Well, the answer is, this square is not really a square, it's a rectangle. it's only got half the symmetry of a square. And what actually happens in these Delaunay-Schlafly symbols is that, how can I say it? That the number of lines in the symbol is the index of symmetry in what it might have been. So this is, this object here is a rectangle, and let me illustrate it a little bit. You see, a rectangle has two types of edge. Got these little edges and the big edges. Okay? And so, I'm sorry, I forgot to sort of label the dimensions here. It's only, this perimeter of this is only a one-dimensional thing, so we won't have two dimensions. What will happen here is that if you're allowed to change vertex number 0, you go from B to B and A to A. Okay, so they're joined to each other, joined to themselves. But if you change vertex number 1, you go from A to B. That's why that's the symbol for a rectangle. And what this means is really rather interesting. It's again true that if I put my thumb over the right-hand thing, I get the symbol for the cell. And we see now that there are two cells, because there are two lines here. There's the long edge and the short edge. Okay? And if I put my thumb over the left-hand part of the symbol, I see there's only one type of vertex. Here it is. But it only has half symmetry, because there are two lines to the symbol. And you can't interchange this end with this end. I mean, a vertex it belongs to one long edge and one short one. very, very lovely thing. let me dualize the symbol of the cube octahedron. To dualize, you just write it backwards. And this is now an object, it's called the rhombic dodecahedron. And now it has only one type of cell, which is not a rectangle, it's a rhombus. Because let's look at this. How many different kinds of cell has it? One. Okay? So all edges of this shape are the same. How many different kinds of vertex has it? Two. Namely, it's got the sharp vertex and the shallow vertex. For the rhombic dodecahedron, this is a rhombus. For the rhombic dodecahedron, what happens? Well, there are two kinds of vertex figures, the interesting thing that happens, because these cells fit together and freeze at some vertices and it falls at others. But each type of vertex has the full symmetry of its kind. That's each of those lines is just one cell. It's absolutely amazing, this symbol. The Schlafly symbol works only for regular polyhedra. Professor Coxeter introduced some graphs, the Coxeter graphs, but they work only really for polyhedra that come from reflection groups, or Coxeter groups. The Delaunay symbol here works for arbitrary polyhedra. It's quite amazing. It specifies the polyhedron uniquely up to combinatorial type. It doesn't show you exactly what the shapes of things are, just the topology. And it's quite a remarkable thing. It's got absolutely delightful properties. It turns out I was just remarking what happens if you cover up the left-hand end or the right-hand end. You can cover up any column, and then you get the orbits on things of the appropriate dimension. Not only that, but from the symbol you can read off the symmetry group of everything. I've already hinted at that when I said that here there's a rectangle, which combinatorially is a square, but with only half the symmetry. This says exactly what the symmetry is as well. And here is a symmetry group of a rhombus. It acts really rather differently. Let's just do another one, and then perhaps I'll leave off that subject. What should we have? Let's take the rhombic cube octahedron. Well, I don't know that I need to demonstrate my skill of drawing a rhombic cube octahedron completely. I'll leave this a little bit unfinished. What is there here? Oh, let me draw this in green. All of these are A's. this type of face here, we have B and C, and that's all. These go B, C, C, B, B, C. Some of the edges, the C edges are near to triangles, the B edges are near to squares. And over here we have D. And let me number some of these vertices and edges and faces. And let's just draw the symbol. This time there are four types of little triangle. A's are connected to themselves at the zero level and the one level. And to B's at the two level. B's are connected to C's at the one level and to themselves at the zero level. C's are connected to D's at the two level. And I think I've finished. C's aren't connected to D's. Okay. So that's the Delaunay symbol, except that I haven't put the little numbers on. So let me just quickly go over what that symbol says. It says, first of all, that there are three types of cell, two squares and one triangle, and one of the squares has only half its symmetry. It has only rectangular symmetry. That square there has only rectangular symmetry. Even if it's a perfect square geometrically, two of its edges are next to triangles and two next to squares. the other square and the triangle are totally symmetric. And over here is the vertex figure. The vertex figure is a quadrilateral, but this time it's only got a quarter of its symmetry. And if you think about it, yes, there are three squares of the typical vertex and one triangle. So one of the four edges is different from all the others. Okay. Well, the last thing I want to say, and I'll just say it very quickly, is another new thing. I don't know, it's not all that new, but it was new to me a few years ago, is the notion of canonical polyhedron. And that's a wonderful thing. Suppose you have a polyhedron that's only specified topologically. What's the best one of it? I mean, if you have a polyhedron like a brick, it's got rectangles of three different shapes, but combinatorially, there are symmetries that take these long rectangles into short ones. And they're all realized in the canonical brick, which is a cube. So we're going to ask, what's the canonical object? I mean, is there one? I didn't realize there was one. But there is. It turns out, a remarkable fact, that all the edges of a cube touch a sphere. Now, I'm not actually going to draw the sphere, I'm just drawing where it hits the faces. All the edges of a cube touch a sphere. And not only that, but the center of gravity of their contact points is the center of the sphere. Well, a polyhedron that has that property is called canonical. And it turns out it's an absolutely beautiful theorem that for any polyhedron that's a topological sphere, there's a unique canonical version of it. And that canonical version has the property, of course, that all the symmetries, all the topological symmetries, are actually realized as symmetries of the model. It turns out, rather remarkably, that all the nicest polyhedra we know are already canonical. If you take the Archimedean polyhedra, one of the Archimedean polyhedra is the truncated cube. Okay, just cut the corners off a cube, and you can cut them off to just such an extent that this face is regular, a regular octagon. Of course, you could cut them off to a smaller extent. You could get an under-truncated cube, or to a larger extent, get an over-truncated cube. But you can make it so that those octagons are regular. I always used to think that was slightly an unnatural thing to do, dignified only by its history, the name Archimedes. But it turns out that this is the canonical one. All the edges of this thing touch a sphere. And not only that, but the center of gravity of contact points is the center of the sphere. Well, it turns out in a precisely similar way, all the Archimedean polyhedra, they are precisely the canonical versions of their topological type. And also, this canonical property is, as it were, self-dual. If at the contact point you take a tangent to the same sphere at right angles to the one you just took, then you get the edges of the dual polyhedron. I hope some of you already know what a dual polyhedron is, because I don't want to explain it. But it turns out, Professor Cox says those are in dual position, I think. But it turns out, you see, the reciprocal of a polytope is in dual position with it only if the sphere you're reciprocating with is tangent to all the edges, which is part of the definition of canonical. And so this property of having a dual polyhedron whose edges cross you at right angles is actually to do with this new notion, at least a notion new to me until recently, of canonicality. I think probably I'll stop there. I'm sure I've overstepped my time, but it's a wonderful thing. I love polyhedra. I'm very, very grateful for Mark for making this sculpture, this wonderful thing. He says we're going to get one in Princeton too, which is going to be very nice. I'm very grateful to the anonymous donor for paying for it. And most of all, I'm grateful for Donald Coxeter for being an inspiration over so many years. Thank you. Yes, absolutely. No matter what your polyhedron is, there's a unique canonical thing. There is something unique about it. It's unique to three dimensions.